Then you know that I don't know in Spanish. please.
Okay, thanks. I guess some of you have seen my talk on Friday. So this one will be that's an overlap for that one. But there's also a lot of stuff that I want to tell you about today that I didn't touch on at all on Friday. So for those who haven't heard about this before, this about the what I call the general boundary formulation of quantum mechanics. So it's a kind of extension of the formalism of quantum mechanics, which is motivated from, among other things, quantum gravity, namely, or rather from the problems we have in bringing together quantum gravity, gravity and quantum theory. So the idea is to perhaps overcome some of these problems by taking a deeper look again at quantum mechanics and how we might extend it. On the other hand, I'm not trying to make some radical changes to quantum mechanics, not like proposing some nonlinear Schrödinger equation or something like that. So I want to save as much of the phenomena as I can. So what's this general boundary formulation meaning? So this is just an overview page, and later I'll go into more detail and really explain the details of what it really is. But kind of the rough idea is that it's kind of the marriage between quantum mechanics and the usual formalism and topological quantum field theory. And here, topological quantum field theory meaning really the mathematical formalism of topological quantum field theory. So to avoid misunderstandings, this doesn't have anything to do with, for example, theories not having local degrees of freedom or anything. So let me explain this better. So if we think about standard quantum mechanics, we have our Hilbert spaces of states, and they are of course associated with the points in time. And then, if you look at a process, the way we think about it is that we have some state at some time t1, and then we evolve the state in time, and at a time t2, for example, we perform a measurement or something like that. Now, if we want to do quantum mechanics in perfect space-time, the picture looks slightly more general in the sense that a priori, we have now different ways of choosing our slicing of the space-time. So we have space-like hypersurfaces that are labeled by the time coordinate in our slicing, and then we have revolutions from between these hypersurfaces. Now, the general boundary formulation is the idea to generalize the setup even further and say what we should really look at is general regions of space-time and their boundaries and associate state spaces with these boundaries. And then what was before a time evolution becomes a kind of generalization of evolution that's associated with the interior. So you can think of this in terms of amplitude that are associated with the interior. As I said, I will say in more detail what I really mean later. By the way, if you have questions, or I don't make things clear enough or whatever, please ask right away, so I want this to be kind of fairly informal. And I want to make sure that the kind of concepts really become clear to everybody. Okay.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, of course.
Okay, so
in what mechanics or what field it is out, kind of domain like next or algorithm relation depends and so on. Know more or less what style of communication is like.
I'm going to draw to that point in the next instance, but ask again if okay, so I said already that's so what I'm about to do is to sort of generalize the space spaces, the boundaries of freedom of space time and amplitudes to the regions themselves. So just kind of an overview slide. So here are some of the features that come out of this or are associated with this. So as I already mentioned, one of the motivations for this is to avoid certain interpretational problems that arise in combining general relativity with quantum mechanics in its standard formulation. So notably the problem of time. So that goes a bit in the direction of what Thomas was saying. And I'll say more about that in the next instance. Also, I already said that the kind of idea here is to preserve standard quantum mechanics where it's applicable or in the domain where we know that it works. An important point is that this kind of picture can be thought of, if we think about a measurement process, as a way to allow a local description of the measurement process. So we don't, I mean, a priori here, these state spaces, if you want, are, well, a priori really extend over all of the universe, right? Of course, in practical quantum mechanical computations and setups, you don't need to talk about all of the universe, but it's kind of somehow behind and leads to problems when you go to quantum gravity. So another interesting thing here is that the distinction between in and out states that we normally have in quantum mechanics kind of gets blurred or disappears, or if you want, the distinction between preparation and observation. Because if you think of it, states living on such a hypersurface, then of course you can't, I mean, it doesn't separate anymore into one piece where you say those are the in-states live here and the out-states live there. And while if you push that to kind of the interpretational aspects of quantum mechanics of products of the wave function and so on, that would mean that the collapse of the wave function is kind of delocalized now. Where would localize them in time? And, well, because I mean here you can say, okay, my system at this time T1, I prepared in a state psi, whatever, then I have the unitary time evolution, and then suddenly when I do the measurement, I have this collapse, right? But here, there is no distinguished moment in time anymore where this collapse is supposed to happen. So that's what I want to say about that. Okay, so let me come now to the problem of time. So I mean, this is well, only a very rough version here, and something much more refined. But well, basically, so the question: what's the analog of time evolution in the quantum theory of gravity? So in a context where space and time themselves are supposed to be quantum, and where I cannot a priori say that I have a classical space-time background, except by maybe one just perturbative. So just consider a kind of very simple difficult setup for an experiment in the lab. So we think of a box, our experiment in a box, that we prepare at some initial time, and initial state, and we wait for some time, and then we observe the final state. Okay, so that's again the picture of the previous slide. Now, the problem I have now is if I want to say, okay, so in the usual formalism, there's this time difference that I have to put in. Now, if space time is supposed to be quantum mechanical, then of course, there's, I cannot a priori talk about such a classical time difference. So, how do I find the notion of time emerging from my theory, this quantum theory of gravity? So, how do I encode this time that I kind of observe in a classical or quasi-classical situation in the formalism? So, and the idea here is that in this general boundary setup, we can describe the experiment in this way. So, we kind of close this boundary where actually our experiment is closed, if you want, so around the box. So, of course, this is space-time picture, right? So, the box is just this interval in space, and that's the time location. So, the boundary here is really all the interior of the box at the beginning of the experiment, then it's the boundary of the box times the time we wait, and then it's again the interior of the box. Okay. But now, so what happens now if I want to think of space-time as kind of quantum mechanical, then I can say that if the experiment that I conduct is such that my state is kind of almost classical in nature, which would usually be the case, then the state on this boundary corresponds roughly to a classical spacetime. Okay? At least on the boundary. So, in particular, that means I can read off in the state the time difference between this moment here and this moment here is by integrating the metric along the path. Metric being the metric associated with this quasi-classical state. Okay, yeah, that's what I just said. Okay, so let me come to another motivation for this from quantum field theory. Or two motivations. Okay, so one comes about from, so with quantum field theory, I mean here the kind of perturbative quantum field theory that we know works so well in the standard model. So if you look at a transition amplitude in the S matrix between initial and final states, which are like, say, imagine you have a state with two particles going to a state with three particles, then the amplitude for this is really the same as if I put one, say, this particle P3 from my out states to the in states, and I mean also I change the sign of momentum and energy. But if under this change, the amplitude is really the same. Of course, if you really calculate a scattering process, you have to take into account the phase factors and so on, so the result will look different. But the important thing is that the kind of raw amplitude really is the same. And in fact, if you do computation to make heavy use of that, when you draw a Feynman diagram, that a priori you can draw a Feynman diagram without specifying which legs are in and which are out. And in fact, this property coming out of quantum field theory is absolutely necessary for this general boundary formulation to work. Because if you just have one boundary, then of course, a priori, you don't have a distinction between this particle being in or out. Right? So I take this as a strong hint that there's something right about this. Okay.
Another motivation comes more from an kind of experimental measurement point of view. So imagine a typical alien physics experiment. You have a particle accelerator, you have a detector, your beams coming in on two sides, and then on the kind of you want the boundary of this detector, which I depict as a cylinder here, you see the particles coming out. So if you draw this in space-time, then of course you get such a picture. So you have an initial time that takes to be the time that the beams turn on, and the final time when the beams turn off. And so this blue line here is now the boundary that describes in an intermediate time coincides with the spatial boundary of the detector. Okay? And so if you look where actually things happen, then the things happen exactly here on the time-like hypersurface. Okay? Because this is where the beam comes in and where the particle comes out. And this is just basically what vacuum, because that's before the beam is switched on, it's after it's switched on. Okay, so the interesting stuff really happens here on the time-like boundary. So maybe we should take this as an indication that perhaps it's a good idea to actually incorporate this into the boundaries. Okay. Okay, so now I'm going to tell you what the general boundary formulation unit is. So that's a bit more formalistic now. So the first thing is we associate state spaces with boundaries of space-time regions. What I'm going to tell you is really a list of axioms, if you want.
So that's the manifold.
Yes, exactly. So this, in the context, you have a manifold, or you talk about, four manifolds M at boundaries from sigma, okay? And in fact, the manifold might have different types of structures depending on what theory you want to describe. So if we talk about boundary quantum field theory, this will be manifold with a metric, and the boundary with a metric, so I'm just in the usual way. And in particular, usually it would even be just a sub manifold of Minkowski space, right, for standard quantum field theory. But then, of course, for different types of theories you want to describe, you will have different types of backgrounds. And for quantum gravity, it would just be either a topological manifold or a differential manifold from the other. If I have time, I'll come back to that one later. Anyway, you associate these state spaces with boundaries, then there are certain rules. For example, if the boundary decomposes into disconnected parts, then for each part we have a state space, and the total state space would be the tensor product of the state space of the components. So that's one rule. Then there's another rule: if you take a boundary and you invert its orientation, so that corresponds to inverting the side on which the interior manifold, the M lives, then this corresponds to the state space being dualized. Okay. That's for state spaces and so on. And then there's the amplitude. And the amplitude, you can think of it as a function from the state space to the complex numbers. And the state space, of course, being the one associated with the boundary of this manifold for which you compute the amplitude. Okay. The boundary of sigma. And so, please ask questions about this kind of formalistic stuff. Because if you see that for the first time, it probably a bit confusing. And a very important rule is the composition rule. So, if you form a manifold by gluing two manifolds together, by the way, when I say manifold, you should really think of space-time region. Maybe I should talk about use the word space-time region order, because that's the physical interpretation behind that. Okay, so if you have two space-time regions that you, that have a common boundary, say this M1 and this M2, say both of them have a boundary that has two components, and this component on this side and here, you can glue them together to make this one space-time region and this one. Then the following rule holds. Okay, here I told you that the amplitude is a function from the state space to the convex numbers. But what you can always do is you can move. So if you have a map between two vector spaces, you can basically move the vector space from the left to the right or the other way around if at the same time you exchange the vector space by its dual space. Okay. I'm a bit sketchy here, but so in particular, in this picture here, so a priori I have an amplitude going from the state space associated with this boundary tensor product, the state space associated with this one, with complex numbers. But if I dualize this now, as I did here, then it's really gives me a map from the state space of this boundary to the state space of that one, or rather the dual state space. Okay. And then if I do the same for this one, I can compose these maps. Okay, so this allows me to define a notion of the position of amplitudes. Yeah, and that's what I'm using here. And the rule is that if I have this composition of space-time regions, it corresponds to a composition of the amplitudes. So it's a constraint on what kind of amplitudes are allowed. Okay, so they have to satisfy this condition.
Robert, how can you induce this map? So if you decompose the H sigma, the H sigma 1 takes H sigma 2. So how do you induce this map that goes from sigma 1 to sigma 2 dual?
Basically, it's just the usual turning around the parallels when you go to dual spaces. So if you have a vector space, another one, you have a map between them. And that induces your map that goes from the dual to the dual of the other one, right? I mean, there's some details in particular. If you talk about infinite dimensional vector spaces, you really have to be careful about that. And there's some
fine. That's not what I mean. The infinite, because I think if you lose some information because you map it with complex numbers.
No, because it's really because then. So here, so this H sigma in this picture, of course, here is a tensor product. Okay, so in a map from this tensor product to the complex numbers, it's the same thing basically as a map from, say, this space to the dual of this space.
This is complex number going to things? So.
Well, you can, yeah, if you write things explicitly in terms of the basis, then, yeah, you know, that's, yeah.
Okay,
fine. Okay, so far these rules are basically the kind of formal rules of what's called a topological quantum field theory. Okay, just to emphasize this fact. Okay, then, of course, for this we need to have something to do with physics. There's a probability rule, which is modeled on the usual one, quantum mechanics. And that's saying that if I have a state, or what they call a generalized state, and evaluate it with the amplitude, then the associated probability, or rather probability density, is the modulo square. Okay. Now, for all this abstract stuff to be more linked to what you're used to, here is the translation kind of how standard quantum mechanics kind of fits into that picture. Okay, so this should help you to understand what the kind of physical meaning of some of these things here are. Okay, so the standard mechanical quantum mechanical situation arises when this manifold or region of space-time that you choose is actually all of space times the time interval. Okay, so then I have this picture here. So that's the red area is my space-time region. Okay, so now the boundary of that is are these blue dashed lines. And of course, as you can see, it has two components, right? One for the initial and one for the final time. Okay, so I, so that means in particular that that this rule applies, and the vector space, the state space, H sigma is to fit with the boundary, really is a tensor product of two, one for each component of the boundary. Okay, and now, in fact, these are exactly the usual Hilbert spaces for mechanics. Okay, so this, the one associated with this boundary, this, yes, the Hilbert space of states at the time t1, and the one associated with the other boundary is the Hilbert space of states at the time t2. Except there's a little star, so it's a kind of dual space. So if you want that sort of space of R vectors, that's one of the vectors. Okay. And then the amplitude associated with a pair of states, so that's, so this tensor product is just one vector in here, one generalized state, but as I said, really can be thought of as a tensor product of an initial and a finite state, is then exactly given by the usual transition amplitude between the initial and the finite state with some time evolution in between.
This is technically common, so in some ways it's the boundary of that. But in some ways that doesn't have to be boundary.
Yes.
So
yeah, I mean, well, yeah, so I know what you're going to say.
So then the composition will tell us that the transition factor, sigma 1 to sigma 2 star, for this projection operator, provided that you don't have any back on any way to get that. So then you're in the setting of strict TPMT. Mm-hmm. But obviously, we want to find that boundary. So this already tells you that you should generalize TPMT to the radical state of more or less.
Yeah, I mean, in particular, I really want it because I want differentiable manifolds. And so then, to be able to compose arbitrary regions, I need corners, obviously, right? So if I want
if
to
you
make...
If you compose hybrids, I mean, so compose it on the timeline.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, this is really just intended to so that it's, it becomes clear in one sense. This is kind of a generalization. Now, this composition rule, so in this context here, if I say I take two regions of space-time that, that look like that, so another one with the time interval T2, T3, say, okay, then obviously we know in quantum mechanics that if I evolve from T1 to T2 and then from T2 to T3, it's the same as if I evolve directly from T1 to T2, right? It's just the composition of the unitary operators.
Can you also identify the induced composition rule for stationary separators?
In ordinary quantum mechanics, no, because there this is not possible. Yeah, so yeah, what I really want to say, so then the composition of time evolutions is a special case of this composition rule. So this composition rule really generalizes the composition of time evolutions on quantum mechanics.
So what you're saying is like, if I think of any quantum, actually, what we were talking about, if we think about the parity, for example, and I do like quantum mechanics from there,
yeah.
And you'd say, well, if you should consider the spatial boundaries of that,
yeah.
Then you would find some sort of correction that in principle should be measurable in laboratory of quantum mechanics.
No, you have to distinguish two things here. So if I'm in a situation where I look, for example, at the boundary like that, like on the previous transparency, then that doesn't necessarily mean that I put like a connecting wall or something.
Well, it means only that you observe a certain box.
Yes.
So the thing that I have any quantum mechanical system, and I observe only a box, and that's really what you always.
Right.
So then you would say that this formalism should bring some sort of correction to...
No. I mean, it's supposed to give the same result as this kind of formalism, because, I mean, it might be that it's actually, it would be more convenient to do your fair relations to make that, that would be the case. But if you do it correctly, then you should get, in both cases, the correct answer. I mean, using both.
I mean,
it's
just in the case that I tried to do it with curved space,
then yeah.
I would find
it correct. Yeah, and well, curved space is really very difficult. I think maybe
while on my very last instance, you may use something. Okay, so well, one thing that I haven't mentioned yet is principally, maybe you noticed that I always talk about vector spaces. I kind of hesitated to talk about this HD-Hilbert spaces because if you think about this context here, for example, I said this is the initial state space, and that's the dual of the final one. Okay, so the usually, so the normal use of the inner product in quantum mechanics that you need so that you can compare initial and final states, you don't really need it here a priori, because the final state automatically is kind of dual to the initial one. Okay. But, of course, the inner product identification of the given state space with its dual can be useful in the context of symmetries. So, and in particular, in quantum theory, there would be CPT. Okay, so basically, CPT would give you such an identity in a natural way. Yes, but if
it's closed, yes.
And it has the reading of all the constants, then it's a cylinder.
A cylinder? Yeah. Yes. Yes. Yeah. So it's not, yeah, of course. Okay, so about this thing about the inner product. So people often ask them when I show this the other thing, what about unitarity, right? Because we're so used to thinking about unitarity as being the thing that somehow ensures that probabilities are conserved or something. Well, the thing here is really that this is really only true if your inner product has the function of enabling to pair initial and final states. So if this is not the function of the inner product, then there's no let me phrase it in a different way. From this point of view, say we want to have an inner product now in our state spaces, okay? And we can think about the inner product as an identical way to identify the state space with its dual, okay? Although we have to be careful because this will be an anti-linear identification, okay? If you want your scalar product to be a usual scalar product, I mean, if you want it to be bilinear, C bilinear form, then this would be C linear, right? It's just a question of what structure you want. So now I assume that you want the one that you bring here. Okay, so let's assume we want that. Okay, I already mentioned that this might be motivated from symmetries and so on. If you want to have this extra structure, then obviously you want this inner product to be compatible in a natural way with all the other structures that I showed on the previous slide, in particular with the amplitude. So you want to be able to exchange evolution in quotes, I mean really the amplitude, with the application of the inner product, or rather with this net that identifies spaces with dual spaces. Okay. So, and it turns out that this compatibility condition is exactly unitarity. Okay, so unitarity means that the amplitudes and the inner products are compatible in a natural way. Okay. So this you can see very nicely in this comment. So if you want to write that in a formal way, it means that this diagram is a commutative diagram. So you take the amplitude function, and then you take the dualization that I already mentioned. So you put this space to the other side, dualize it, and then you compare this amplitude function proposed with this dualization, you compare it with this identification between space and dual space, and they are the same. And there's also a complex conjugation here related to this anti-linearity. If that is the same, so this diagram commutes, then you say that whatever the inner product or is unitary. Okay. And so in the standard context where this state space is the product of the initial state, state space and the final one, you can really, so this diagram becomes this diagram. I mean, I don't go too much into the details, but so if you call the map from H1 to H2 that corresponds to the amplitude, you should think of this as your time evolution operator, then this condition translates exactly into this equation, which, well, up to some notational subtleties, is exactly the equation for a unitary operator. Okay. So it's really exactly that thing. Unitary is exactly this complicated. Okay, so far I've talked about the formalism. Now, of course, if we extend quantum mechanics in this way, then we have to rethink also the way how we produce quantum theories, right? I mean, usually we're producing by quantization, that is, we take some classical theory, we apply some recipe, more or less determined, and then we get something that fits into the standard quantum mechanical formalism. But now I have this extended formalism, so it should fit into this extended formalism. So what kind of quantization can I use to derive here? And the kind of most obvious candidates is path-integral quantization. So in a sense, the rules that I showed you are in a sense made such that they agree with path-integral quantization, or a different point of view is to say that topological quantum theory historically kind of emerged from path-integrals, and so it's not surprising that the things are compatible. Okay, so how to produce quantum theories of this kind of boundary type. Okay, so that's just a very rough sketch of the path integral quantization adapted to this context. So say you have some classical mechanical system or rather field theory with variables of fields phi and your action. Okay, so you now look at some space-time region with boundary and say, so that would be the topology of the forward, for example. So you first start, it's very kind of analogous to building up one mechanical quantization into one. So just you look at the space of configurations of the field on this hypersurface. So for example, this can be in non-relativistic quantum mechanics target positions or events, or it can be the value of your field on this boundary. Okay? So this would be natural candidates. And then you just say, okay, the state space is now the space of complex functions on this configuration space. So that's really, yeah, space of. So you can think of this as the space of wave functions or wave functionals, but they are generalized wave functions. When I come to the examples later, I hope that this will come more clear. And then the amplitude function. So remember, it's a map from the state space to the complex numbers. It's just given by the path integral in this way. So the state is a function on this configuration space. So I call this psi here, so I call phi tilde a configuration on the boundary of, say, my field. And so this is an integral over these configurations on the boundary. And then I weight this integral here with the path integral in the interior of the exponential of the action over all possible field configurations in the interior. Get on the boundary reduced to the field configuration that I put here. That's in here. Okay. Okay, so maybe the best idea is now to go to examples and to see how does this look like. And so in particular, my examples will be non-relativistic quantum mechanics. And then
with Frank Gordon from Dietary. So, but please ask questions if things are not so clear.
Suppose it's going to be a two-dimensional feature.
What do you mean by split?
And now you have this description for the evaluation of this whole
element. Right.
So I have two points and I have an illustration that second split is two points.
So wait, you want to change your manifold?
Oh, yeah, it's two points.
You mean you take a manifold like this and you remove two points on the manifold?
I'm going to do that one from the
situation. Yeah.
And then you just make something simple, the boundaries and so.
Yeah.
Then I apply your description and get a number.
Right.
But then I just remove two points to get a
from the manifold,
from the boundary.
Well, I mean, that depends on what kind of context. I mean, usually you can't do that, right? Because, how is the manifold a topological manifold?
So you don't know what?
No, maybe you can construct some theory where you can do such things, but a priori, you would really have to think about how to do it so that it's consistent. But I mean, I'm really in the context, so say if we have quantum mechanics of quantum field theory, this is really a metric manifold, it was a metric boundary and so on. But for quantum gravity, it would be probably a differential manifold, because the differential boundary, but there still I cannot do it, right? Yes.
Well, it's a conformal theory, and it wouldn't also be seen as having its truth. So it's kind of a very interesting. So in safety, it's a little bit of a different. It was conformal theory, because it's true. Because it's kind of a boundary. Where you have to specify the boundary.
Now, it was just interesting in whether this could affect somehow what is worth it in this particular case. But he said it's not allowed. He probably had to split this into two halves or get two new space time bounds. So it's not allowed.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's only on the means of safety, of moving to the
Okay, so let me come to the more down-to-earth examples that should hopefully illuminate some things about this. I start with non-relativistic quantum mechanics. Okay, so everything's very simple, and even free particles moving around, okay? So we just start with 1-5. Yes, that's pretty easy. So we have the action and the solution of the equation of motion obviously are just straight lines, okay, with the constraint that they might not just be straight lines in equal time, because apart from that condition straight lines. So now let's first think about the standard setup with my space-time region being this time interval times all of space and having the boundary that composes it to these two parts. So here's just a classical configuration. Now I draw in all of space-time. So actually, a configuration for this one particle situation really corresponds just to a pair of points. So one point on this initial fiber surface and one point on the final fiber surface. The points in the classical positions of the particle. as I said, the state space would be in this case of functions on that. And of course, since we have this decomposition into these two components, it decomposes into the temporal product of two,
And the two components are just the usual wave function of the particle, this being the wave function at the time t1, and this part corresponding to the wave function at the time t2. Okay, so it's really just the ordinary Schrödinger thing, except for the fact that we take look at two times together. Okay, so now if I take a state in the space, or if you want this generalized wave function, in particular I think about it as a product of the wave function here, the wave function here. So if I think of it in that way, I write it like this. In general, of course, it can be an arbitrary linear combination of such products. And then if I apply this path integral rule, I just get the usual Feynman path integral of quantum mechanics. So the integral of the perturbations on the boundary becomes the integral over the initial position and over the final position of the wave, the initial and the final wave function, and then weighted with the path integral, which is the sum of all histories of the particle, quantum histories, if you want, that are constrained to the particle being at point x1, at t1, and at point x2, at times t2. Okay?
Yeah. It's a two-way function, not entangled, then with the interpretation.
That corresponds to what I said before, that if you take here a linear combination of such products of wave function, that there would be an entangled.
But then what is the definition of the material?
Yeah, I mean, then you just have the interpretation is just that you have a linear combination of standard amplitudes. Okay, so so far I have referred only to the kind of standard situation with the standard boundaries. So let's be a bit more general. First of all, obviously if I go from one particle to any particles, the only thing that changes with all that the configuration space is just the product of the one particle configuration spaces. And so I have n particle wave functions, and this space is the space of products of initial and final in particle wave functions, if you want, and then in their combinations. Okay, so now let's have some fun and change the boundaries and do something more general. So, for example, look at this situation here. So, the space time region, say, being a four ball. And so the boundary is the free sphere here. Now, what's the configuration space? It's, again, I have one particle, so if I see the particle, it goes in somewhere and comes out again later somewhere else from this hypersurface. So I the configuration space is the space of pairs of points, t1 x1 and t2 x2 on this free sphere, with the constraint that the initial time is earlier than the final time. And then my state space is just space functions, or the one function is on this configuration space. So these are, again, these generalized wave functions. But of course now, they don't factorize anymore. I mean, this space doesn't factorize in the part for the initial and for the final one. So it's, you cannot anymore think of it as the elements being products in initial wave functions times final wave function. Okay, so this is a situation where you already see that this a priori distinction between the in and out states doesn't work anymore in the usual way. Okay, so let's see if this whole thing is consistent with the axioms. So in particular, let's look at the composition rule. Okay, so here is just a sketch of the situation where I have the kind of standard boundaries,
And then here I take a space-time region, which is the same as it said, that I cut out this four ball here, and then I here's this four ball. So this obviously is the reunion of those two manifolds here, which according to my rules means that the amplitude associated with this must be the composition of the amplitude associated with those two situations. Okay. Now, if I think about that, I know that the amplitude is given by the path integral. So here, there's one contribution to the amplitude here that arises in this situation. Now, if you look at it, you will see that so this trajectory here is a trajectory that intersects this Hilbert phase not only twice, so it doesn't not only goes it in and comes out, but it goes in again and comes out again. So now, if we say that our state space for this type of boundary is the one that I introduced here, we have a problem because this amplitude will not appear as a position. The composition that will only appear amplitudes where particle goes in here once comes out once. So this equality would be violated. So the composition rule would be violated. So, yeah.
Is that true for any signal? I think about the course of visual design and the course of glass truth. So,
yeah, no, so and you can.
So, in that case, I think that would be one of the most.
Right. So, you can make up situations where you can probably manage to avoid this.
But it's not both.
Yeah, no, I mean, sorry, yeah, one thing, I mean, this in the context of non-relative is important, so you cannot do that there, but if you want to kind of go to one gig, then, well, yeah, I mean, here it's really, you mean they go back in time?
No, they go back in time. Yeah, but the amplitude is your
Yeah, so the lesson from that is, so, well, can we fix this? And of course we can, but the way to do it is that what we really need for this composition to work, we need the state space associated with this foil here to be really the state space that's a direct sum of all state spaces for all particle numbers. Okay, so we see that for the general boundary formulation to work in this non-relativistic quantum mechanical setup, we force it to be a force to state spaces that are allow any number of particles. Okay, so we see something that we are normally used to seeing only in quantum field theory already appear in non-relativistic quantum mechanics. So that's And well, of course, we know that in physics this is really true. So, from that point of view, it's not a bad news, but rather good news. So now I want to just say something about Klein-Gordon quantum field theory. Let's see how far I get.
But before you do this, can you actually graph it just for the board?
You mean evaluate the path integral?
Yes.
No, in fact, in general, that's very difficult. It's very difficult. And, I mean, so far, I mean, in the non-relativistic case, I haven't looked at further evaluate. I mean, in the quantum field theory case that I will talk now about, yeah, what do you mean by it? I mean, formally, from a formal point of view, I mean, given the definition of rho with the path integral, I mean, doing that will exactly solve the problem and ensure that the theory is consistent. That, I mean, all compositions work and so on. So that, but that's, of course, you can say, okay, it's formal, I want to see the actual numbers and so on. So then, decide.
What's the limitation?
Well,
Well, okay, so in a simpler way, the interpretation is, I mean, if you look at this boundary, I mean, now forget these boundaries, is that your knowledge about the experiment is that, let me put it in a different way. So the probability density that you get as modulus square of the amplitude, say, here on this boundary with one going in, one going out, one in, one out, is the probability density of finding this combination of particles either coming into in here, so this would go in, this goes in, or going out, so this goes out and this goes out. But so to give it a physical meaning, you have to specify what is your a priori knowledge about the experiment and what probabilities we want to compare. So for example, you could say, so this particle coming in here is fixed because that's like my experiment, some source of particles that goes in there. Okay? And then this is here, there are some detectors around. So you want to compare the probabilities of different outcomes here. And then of course all this, you have to factor this with what happens here and so on. So you're really talking about, when you talk about the probability densities, these are, you should think of them as conditional probabilities, conditional probability densities, depending on what you know, what you don't know, and measure about the experiment. I have one transparency about this, the problem is that I don't have enough time to show this if I want to also to show this.
Maybe we can talk about it later.
Yeah. Yeah, that's my next example. I mean, by the way, quantum theory. Yeah, I mean, it's again basically particles that we talk about. So it's
this actually is tied to the
vacuum, to the definition of the vacuum. Let's see if I have time. Okay, so the theory I'm looking at is just a free scalar quantum field theory, so then modern quantum field theory. First I have to remind you some things about this theory, that because the way to treat it is using the Schrödinger representation, which is slightly unusual and normally not done in textbooks. Okay. The problem is I'm not sure how much longer you want to stay here.
It's 1 hour.
It's like high transparency, so it's I can go to the outlook, and then if a few people want to know more about the quantum field theory situation, we make a like little informal thing for them. The problem is to for you to understand what the formula means, I have to show you the other stuff first. So I go to the outcome now. Some of the things that I hear will seem a bit faint. So this is
just about a few applications of the general boundary formulation to different contexts or theories. So one is, first one is perturbative quantum field theory, and that's the stuff that I will tell after this to anybody who's interested. But this obviously is the outlook, so based on what I've done, one of the next steps I would like to do is to derive the S matrix of whatever the quantum field theory is right now, but in a kind of conceptually more satisfactory way, in particular using finite boundaries. Because if you remember your textbook learning about the S matrix, when it's derived, you start with, you talk about particles at an initial time and particles at a later time that you think of as being free, so you kind of turn off the interaction at a very early and very late time. But in reality, the S matrix describes a stationary process. So, in a sense, the very notion of the S matrix and this kind of simplification you do at the beginning disagree with each other. Of course, we know that somehow it gives us the right result, but from a conceptual point of view, it's not really that satisfying to make this kind of contradictory assumptions. One thing that I like to do is to have a nicer way of writing the S matrix in a setting where you can kind of rigorously justify the assumptions. Mm. So then another thing is also related to in general boundaries. Obviously, the particle concepts, in a sense, gets generalized, and one hope would be that this would help one understand the concept of particle that's perhaps local and doesn't need a global notion and structure of space-time. That's also related to the problem in quantum gravity, obviously. Then if we, in particular, if we go to quantum field theory and purpose space-time, then this is an essential question there. So the kind of hope would be to go to a more local description that doesn't really need to know about space-time and infinity and so on. And so, for example, one thing one might like want to do is rewrite the Kunming effect in such a kind of more local way. Because physically speaking, it's really something that shouldn't depend on how the universe looks very far away. Right? So. Then application of non-perturbative quantum field theory, so in particular lead escapes theory. I wrote their renormalization of compactification. Usually in lattice space theory, what we do to keep your kind of lattice stationary small is you go through torus usually in space and time of your lattice, so you compactify it. But this of course introduces undesirable physical consequences, the finite size effects, and you have conceptual questions how this justified and so on. So the idea is that while many of these things are actually already work in progress, in particular this one, is to do that with finite space-time and work with the boundary states to fix the minimization. One obvious question I talked about catalytic quantization, but obvious question would be, can we extend what canonical quantization is to this kind of more general context? And of course, this would be in particular a question if we want to have something like a boundary to quantum gravity. So, do quantum gravity statement on a closed boundary of the region of space time? Then, first, we have to rethink what the quantization means, and then we can try to apply it in that context. Now, another thing. Three-dimensional quantum gravity, like for example, as the one talked about it this weekend, is a theory that fits exactly into this framework. And so this would be a test bed for the interpretation aspects of this in terms of measurement, what's a measurement as well. And for spin-form models, if you want to connect it to spin-form models, you would have to think about string form models with boundary, in particular with boundaries that are can be spaced like in time. Okay, so I want to stop here.
For the general relativity, it turns out to be a security with corners. Then the problem of time is the big problem.
It's what?
It's a big problem, it's a zero problem.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, and if you want to be so strong in this thing, you want to.
Is it the session that you want to use? The IS on top of it, or you can move in the way to
it? Yeah, no, it's not. I mean, whether it's Minkowskian or Euclidean, it's not an extension.
Okay, then.
I mean, it shouldn't be. I mean, but of course, in you have to, if you look at a concrete theory, you have to ask the question model by model.
So then, let me go back to the three non-relativistic models.
There.